Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for your patience. Kind of get ourselves sorted. I think poor Rebecca actually ran from her previous venue to here, so she needed a bit of time to catch her breath.
Over. Back from somewhere, and there was a white guy sitting opposite me, and he leaned towards me and he said, can I ask you something? And I thought he was just going to ask me what time the train got in or something. And I said, yeah, of course. And he said, why do you hate us so much? And my heart broke. I absolutely felt heartbroken.
Absolutely.
That this guy, who obviously doesn't know any other brown people, had seen a brown person, and this was shortly after the 7/7 attacks. And I said to him, I'm really sorry you feel that way. We don't. We absolutely don't. And thankfully, he just leant back in his seat and seemed to accept what I said. But I think we have to work harder, all of us, and I'm sure you're doing good work, to change this image of, you know, people who follow Islam as a faith as potential suicide bombers, potential martyrs. And I'm really sorry to say it, I think an awful lot of, you know, people who should know better see most Muslims as potential suicide bombers. Even in this day and age, it's very sad.
So I think that what I'm hearing is that you're all saying that you think there are legitimate expressions and important expressions of martyrdom, and there are also expressions of martyrdom which are problematic or which you see as being, you know, not legitimate. That's correct? And I suppose that when in the program it talks about there being a sort of, you know, resurgence of martyrdom, I imagine that that's talking about the not legitimate aspects of it. Would you say that's true? And I think that what you've said, Abdul, is that you think that what lies behind that is extreme situations, feelings of desperation and helplessness, and so on.
I do, and yet, in the spirit of honesty, I think even illegitimate forms of political or violent expression raise some very difficult questions for us. Mm-hmm. What of the person who does what she or he does, thinking that what they're doing is blessed and righteous and right? That at that moment that they do it, are they convinced of it? Are they deluded? Is it something satanic? Are they in a state of a psychic dissonance? Is it a psychological problem as opposed to a spiritual problem? I often think of that because I knew somebody who became a suicide bomber. I knew him somewhat well, not terribly closely, but in the late 1990s, I used to come to the United Kingdom a lot, worked for a magazine called Q News, and used to work with various community groups, because the Muslim scene here in the UK was pretty darn exciting. And I was a young activist and energetic and all those things, and So I remember I met this young man. He was just like a big teddy bear. He was just a really sweet guy. I'll say his name because his name is a matter of record, Asif Hanif. And Asif in West London met him at a number of events, and you know, he, like I said, just a remarkably sweet and gentle personality. Had some difficult personal circumstances. But I think we were really stunned when in 2003, I believe, he went to Tel Aviv and blew himself up in an area just outside a pizzeria and killed several people, including himself. And I think for those of us, you know, he was affiliated with what are called traditional, you know, Muslim environments, had connection to Sufi sheikhs, like many of us did. And it really made us think really deeply, and it was not just heartbreaking, but actually just distressing, that how did this happen? How did this happen to someone within our broader circle had gone from this point where we had traveled first to Damascus and then had gone on to Jordan, and from Jordan something had happened in that period. As a journalist, I worked on the story for Channel 4 for Channel 4 documentary for a short period of time. So I know something about the journey that he took. But he ended up in Palestine, and he ended up committing this act. Everyone who knew him would tell you that he was a remarkably gentle and sweet and good-natured person. Of course, things came out, but that raises a whole bunch of personal questions. What happened? How did he get there? What kind of convincing case was made? He was clearly angry. I mean, he was clearly angry and devastated. He initially actually had gone to Iraq. That was his agenda. His agenda was to go to Iraq and to fight against the forces of occupation in Iraq, and ended up in Tel Aviv. So those are the kind of difficult questions that are raised. I think there's another set of difficult questions, which I think we as a British audience will understand, is that when we now, I mean, Rebecca, you spoke about resistance. Now, from our point of view, of course, the attacks against British troops in Afghanistan or in Iraq may be illegitimate. But there are people in Afghanistan and Iraq who think they're very legitimate. And there are many individuals who would undertake the greatest sacrifice because they think they're opposing an occupying force and they're opposing occupation. The same argument that may be used by those who oppose the Israeli Defense Forces in occupied Palestine. I think that also for us in the West and in the United Kingdom and being British raises some serious questions. Our government now, for the record, that if you are an organization, particularly a Muslim organization, if you countenance the legitimacy of opposing, of forces that oppose British forces outside of the United Kingdom, in Afghanistan or Iraq or elsewhere, you are no longer deemed an organization that can be legitimately engaged with when it comes to some very sensitive community outreach issues. So now this has become a matter of policy. My response to government, and I've said this to members of the civil service who we've worked with in the past around these issues, is that this raises actually a whole range of very difficult questions. Would we have the same reaction to members of people like George Orwell who fought against the Spanish fascists even when our governments stood aside when that battle was going on? I think that raises some difficult questions. I think those are some moral and ethical dilemmas.
Well, what we do is just see what you're all thinking about this now. And someone's got their hand up straight away over there. There's a lady over there with...
I'm interested to ask what you think, in that I believe that martyrdom isn't something one does with intent. It seems to me that if you're going out to be a martyr, that isn't martyrdom, that actually what you're doing is living or dying for your faith, for what you called the greater good, and that if death happens, that's martyrdom. But to think about martyrdom is something that you go out to do, kill yourself, it seems to me that that should have another name.
Okay, I mean, do you want to...
That's a really interesting point, and I'm really sorry, I didn't bring my notes with me tonight, but some of the issues you touched upon, there is actually a great deal of social science research on martyrdom and suicide bombing with some really interesting findings. So we've talked here about theological motivations for martyrdom and so forth. And what the research discovered was that strong religious belief was not a necessary factor for people to become suicide bombers. So people who have actually killed themselves, researchers have gone and spoken to them. And what they found is that it wasn't necessarily a firm belief in paradise or that they were doing something for Allah or whatever, that there were other weird social pressures at play. So, for example, peer pressure. So somebody whose elder brother had been a martyr might feel that they needed to prove themselves to their family, for example, and to their wider community. Can you imagine? You know, it's nothing to do with God or whatever. They just felt this weird pressure that they had to kill themselves in order to be the kind of man that they thought they ought to be. And also, if you think about the 7/7 attacks, the Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden was not a suicide bomber. Mm-hmm. He managed other suicide bombers. He manipulated other people into becoming suicide bombers. That manipulation has been studied and understood to some extent. And what often happens in that they tend to work in cells and groups of people, and there's a very good reason for that. If you have a group of people who commit to an act of martyrdom, if that's what we want to call it, then they pressure each other into carrying out the act. A solo person, a person on their own, is far less likely to come up with the idea and carry it out because they can talk themselves out of it. But there are in these groups a weird form of peer pressure at play. I don't want to get into the kind of semantic arguments about whether, you know, God judges you as a martyr if you die nobly, or if you're a political martyr or whatnot. I feel for the purposes of this discussion, we've come up with a number of definitions already.
Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask if maybe, like, I come from a tradition of the Mennonites, and we have the Martyr's Mirror, which is basically a history from below, starting with the martyrdom of Jesus and going through the entire history of the church until the time that it was written in the 16th century, I think, or 17th, and documenting also all the people in that Anabaptist movement who were put to death for their beliefs. And it's a very strong book in documenting all this suffering, which was repressed also by the official political narrative. And so I wondered if somebody had some thoughts on that, in maybe broadening that out and also including modern martyrs like Martin Luther King, but also people like Tom Fox, who died in Iraq, fighting non-violently, fighting the occupation of Iraq, and then through sad circumstances, ended up being killed by terrorists. But if somebody had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, some of the criterion I see for martyrdom is, first of all, the people who martyr you must be hostile to your faith. You must do no violence to them. So you can't be a martyr if you go out with a suicide belt strapped to your chest and blow someone up and die yourself. That doesn't make you a martyr because you've done violence to the other side. Similarly, mercenary soldiers who went to fight for a Spanish Republican government that was itself killing priests and burning churches, they can't be martyrs. The second thing I'd like to draw attention to is that you can also have a white martyrdom as well as a red martyrdom, which means not an immediate death, but a life of suffering lived as a result of bearing witness for your faith, often long years in prison. Or a classic modern case would be Pope John Paul II, who was shot in St. Peter's Square and suffered for the rest of his life and died many, many years later. His was a white martyrdom as opposed to a red martyrdom.
Let me respond just a little bit to that, just to offer a different interpretation from a Christian perspective. I don't believe to be a witness, a faithful and courageous witness to that which we know is good and that which we're defending and holding to, that suffering has to be involved. So I offered a definition of martyr that you suffer, or that you suffer violation, or that you're victimized, or that you have pain. None of those things make you a martyr in my way of defining martyrdom, which is a Christian way of defining martyrdom. What makes you a martyr is the courage and faithfulness, the heart, the depth of your love. So another example, I think, of a contemporary martyr, and I want to thank you for lifting up the name of Tom Fox, one of the Christian peacemakers witnessing in Iraq, who's lost his life there. But another example I'd lift up is Julia Butterfly Hill, who is one of the environmental activists who some of you may know about. This in my state of California, one of our struggles is to preserve the old growth forests, the ancient redwood forests, which are almost completely wiped out now. And Julia Butterfly Hill was a leader of this movement of young, very young people who, for the love of the forest and defense of the earth, made a home in the tops of the trees, of these big redwood trees, and said to the lumber companies, if you're going to cut down this tree, you're going to cut down this tree with me in it. And so she put her life, and others who did this, put their life on the line to save the trees, to defend the trees. Mm-hmm. She stayed up there, and a whole community of people supported her by getting food to her. She stayed up in a tree for like 180 days or some long, somebody knows this story better than I do. And it was a form of struggle against deforestation. She put herself at risk, but what put her at risk, and what puts many of those who we see as martyrs at risk, like Martin Luther King, who was killed, is the people who opposed them. And when we valorize the martyr for their pain, or as if there were some virtue in suffering or deprivation, we often disappear the actors or the perpetrators who are opposing their struggle for justice. And so the martyr gets valorized, and the person responsible for their suffering, or the forces responsible for their suffering, are no longer in the limelight, are somehow disappeared. And I think that's a moral error, that martyrdom, certain views of martyrdom lead us to make a moral error in which we valorize the pain or the violation that happened, and we somehow the perpetrator of that violence then becomes part of God's action of making somebody a martyr. I think that's wrong.
Okay, the gentleman on the front here.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating debate so far. When you started the conversation, you said about being a Protestant in Liverpool. In 1995, a group of us went on a walking pilgrimage. We actually looked at martyrdom, Catholics and Protestants. And right at the core, when we looked at it all, is how do you deal with evil? How do you deal with tyranny? And a lot of the stuff that came out here was how do you deal as Muslims in the world with the tyranny that is coming up? And one of the things that came up was the Tudor family, pretty much dysfunctional, but Bloody Mary killing the Protestants or vice versa. Mm. And these were people of faith who hung on to their faith and would not be changed by the forces that came against them and died for their faith. They were martyrs who, in my eyes, were holy. They didn't choose this, but they chose to not accept the evil that was coming towards them. Where I get very worried is when evil, you get sucked into evil as a response to evil. And it really concerns me when I hear, to me, when I look, and this is a very rough generalization, but when I look at Christian martyrs, I tend to see people who have been killed by tyranny, wherever it's coming from evil. When I look at Islamic martyrs, what worries me is I often see them dying, killing other people. And that does concern me, because it then becomes another evil against evil. And I'd like to, you know, just hear some comments back on that, because I've been to a fascinating series of lectures by John Deere, and his response is about pacifism and not getting caught up in violence. And right at the core of Judaism and Islam and Christianity should be that commandment, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah, ever. I mean, I think for anybody else answers, if I can just say, you know, I mean, I think that there's plenty of examples of that, of overcoming evil with evil within Christianity, you know. I mean, at the moment, there's kind of quite a lot of you know, media focus on the way that we see that within the Islamic context, but there's plenty within Christianity. You know, I mean, obviously, you just need to go back to the Crusades as a starting point. But I think that, you know, there's an enormous amount of, you know, violence that is used in, for instance, you know, fighting for pro-life causes or lots of other things. So I think I just wanted to flag up the fact that it does not belong to any one particular religious tradition.
I want to second that and just challenge what you said, that we hear about Christians getting killed by evil, but the idea. During the Crusades, the Christian Crusades, you have the edict from the Pope that anybody who dies, gives their life going on the Crusade, or dies in the effort to kill Jews and kill Muslims, which is what Christians were enjoined to do in the Crusades, will go straight to the heavenly paradise, and all their sins will be forgiven. So this idea that you go straight to paradise if you die as a martyr, is a very strong in medieval Christian piety, and it's a justification for holy war. So I just think it's very important for us as Christians to know that this thing that I learned from Abdul yesterday, that whole thing of criticizing the Muslim suicide bombers for having this idea that they're going to go to paradise and get the 72 virgins was really entered into public discourse by anti-Muslim, right-wing, non-Muslims. Those of us who are Christians need to know this. That theology that Christians have criticized Muslims for is also present in Christian spirituality,
I just totally agree with what you've just said. Sorry, the point I was trying to make
is that
the martyrdom is when somebody's been killed, like the point made over there. I'm not talking about crusades, holy war, there isn't one.
Your underlying point is that it's when you are on the receiving end of...
And how do you deal with evil peacefully?
Yeah.
I think this is a very important question, and I think there is two issues, and let's deal with them separately. I think there is, and someone else raised this, is there, for lack of a better word, a non-violent tradition within Islam and within the Islamic understanding of resistance? And I would say there is, and there has been at various points in Muslim history that non-violent resistance. Abdul Ghaffar Khan, who was a contemporary of Mahatma Gandhi, was a devout Muslim from the Northwest Frontier. His tradition still lives on in the Northwest Frontier in Pakistan, was a proponent of non-violence. There's been scholars of the modern age who, as well. And I think at the same time, like in Judaism and Christianity, there is also a martial tradition and a conception of just war, and a sense that war is at times necessary, and when it is necessary, there is a way to execute it within certain broad moral and ethical principles. Today we would probably reference things like the Geneva Conventions. I think that tradition is strong. There is a martial tradition in Islam, there's no doubt about it. There is a martial jihad in Islam, there's no doubt about that. And a lot has been said about it, a lot has been written about it. Within Islamic history, were the warfares carried out that were often called jihads actually jihads? There's a lot of dispute about that, and there was dispute at the time those actions were caused. As a Muslim, I have to say that there are times when evil and tyranny must be met with force, and I recognize the legitimacy of force against that. At the same time, I along with many other Muslims, particularly now and within our communities, as we speak about tactics and action, non-violence, and particularly a very dear friend and scholar of mine, Imam Johari Abdul Malik, who's from the African-American Muslim community just outside Washington, D.C., has recently launched a campaign around non-violent forms of resistance. And that is being replicated in places like the Sudan and elsewhere. So I do think there is a tradition, and that is being revived. So there is a tension. And there is a discussion about that. Is killing in and of itself evil? Yes, necessary evil at times, just war theory would tell us, yes. I think actually about, in Iraq, the hundreds of thousands of people who lost their lives. Would I consider them martyrs? And I would. Story after story tells us how families sought to defend themselves. Fathers and mothers sought to defend children. Children sought to defend their elders. The women who were raped and killed in places like Fallujah, are they martyrs? Absolutely. I have no doubt that they have their highest reward with God for the great suffering that they experienced in the hands of illegitimate occupation. I also understand the response to that, which has taken place in Iraq and elsewhere. I think what you've highlighted is sort of the moral fault lines, the high morality, applied morality, and what a religion and faith and the sacred texts, what leeway they allow us. And I think right now in places like Nigeria, where we hear a lot about organizations like the Boko Haram and their attacks on Christian churches, but also about Christ's army and the Lord's army elsewhere, and those Christians who are taking up arms. I think about Rwanda, where Christian churches sat, many of them, sat aside while great horrors were inflicted upon them. And in fact, in Rwanda, we have a beautiful example in contemporary time of a Muslim community who was less than 5% of the population, but saved nearly 125,000 people because mosques and Islamic schools were used as places of refuge. There's a beautiful movie that just came out, which we had the honor of being part of its first UK showing last December, called Kenya Rwanda, which is a Rwandan-American co-production, which tells us a remarkable story of how Muslim communities helped those members of tribes who were being killed in saving them, but also then gave up the mosque. There's some beautiful stories of where mosques were literally, parts of mosque were set aside, and the cross was erected in the mosque for Christian worship, where the grounds of schools where people would pray, that the imams and the mufti of Rwanda at the time said that you know, allow for the crosses to be erected and for the prayers to be said and for Christians to come in and pray. I think these are stories we need to hear more about. Why? Because they show us that beyond the dogma and the polemic, that our faiths have this incredibly generous capacity. Now, some would say that's a human capacity. Alam, I'm sure, would say that, and you're absolutely right. It is a human. But for me, that generosity, that recognition that we are all God's creation, is actually a profoundly spiritual recognition. And there's some beautiful moments where there's a Christian in the film, which they're all true stories, in this particular film that and the producer was with us, and she told us a story about a young woman who was a Christian and had come in to the mosque and had been given refuge, and her life had been saved, and how eventually she marries, you know, it was a Hutu and Tutsi, so two people who were in love who couldn't actually get married or have a relationship, that how it was on the grounds of the mosque after the end of the genocide that the priest carried out the service on the grounds of the mosque and everyone celebrated. And I think those are remarkable examples, of hopeful examples that we have. But these are murky. I don't think they're easy waters. These are murky waters. But we have to be honest with ourselves, and I have to be honest as a Muslim. And I can't sort of paper over the fact that there is a martial tradition in Islam. There is a tradition of war and rules of engagement. It's how we apply that. And sometimes I think the question that Muslims now have to ask, and what our scholars are saying, is that there's a time and place to apply sacred law. Now is not the time and place to apply. And everything is contextual. And we have to understand context.
I'd just like to pick up on something that Rebecca said very early on in your remarks about this. You had a friend who didn't see salvation in the death of Christ. I think that the death of Jesus. I think that's what you said. I think there is such a thing as redemption through suffering. And I think I found that in my own life. You know, you might say that that it's the love of Christ that brings about salvation rather than the suffering of Jesus. But in a sense, those two are kind of two sides of the same coin, perhaps. Mm. I just wonder whether you'd like to comment on that.
He's asking it. Could you all hear this question? Mm. He's saying that there's asking me to say some more about my friend who didn't believe Jesus' death on the cross was redemptive, that the suffering or violence that Jesus endured was redemptive. That was my grandmother, but that's also my view. That's also been my critique as a theologian. I know that there are experiences we have as human beings of profound suffering in which we come to know more deeply the presence and the grace of God and find healing or transformation through those experiences. I wrote a book with my friend Rita Nakashima Brock called Proverbs of Ashes, which is a line from Job. Job complained that his friends were explaining his suffering with bad theology. And one of the part, and he says, your maxims are proverbs of ashes. And Job's friends were telling him that his suffering was going to lead to a good end, or his suffering was a sign that God loved him more than other people. Or you can read all the things Job's friend says. Job rejects all of it as bad theology. In Proverbs of Ashes, we trouble and grapple with all the ways in which Christian spirituality has said that violence brings about redemption, and the violence that happened to Jesus was redemptive, or that suffering and pain are pathways to transformation. So the theological, it's a very subtle point at some level. the theological witness that I would make is that in experiences of profound deprivation and pain, sometimes the face of God is revealed to us more clearly. Those of us who have those experiences, the face of God comes more clearly. The presence of God is felt more keenly. But it's not this, someone said to me, no one should have to come to know God this way. So that's a very subtle point. That it's not the pain, or it's not the pain that shows us God. God shows us God. So it's still, I would affirm, the grace of God, or the presence of the Holy Spirit comes to those who suffer, but it comes to all of us. The Spirit is present to all of us. God is with all of us. In situations of greatest deprivation, sometimes we see it, God's presence, most vividly. But it's not the pain that makes us see, it's God's presence. So I do think there's a difference, and I think it's a very slippery slope when we start privileging suffering or pain as the ways of knowing God.
Okay, we've probably got about no more than 10 minutes, really. So put your hand up if you've got something you really would like to say or to ask. Just let me see if there are hands around. Okay, so there's that one there.
I'd like to raise the question of choice. You spoke of the book of the martyrs, the
Fox's Book of Martyrs.
That's right. Often, these martyrs were faced with a choice. If you renounce your faith, you will live. If you do not renounce your faith, you will die. That was the situation that ran through a lot of the examples that you find in that book. Now, it's not a matter of intellectual thought. It's a matter of what they believe. And when the people who die now, rather than renounce their faith, are regarded as members by thousands of the people.
Just hold the microphone right up to your mouth.
Who are members of that faith, all right? They are regarded as martyrs. Now, this question of the choice is very vital to this discussion, as I see it, and I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Good question. I commented on the last one. I'd love to comment on that, but I don't want to monopolize the discussion. Maybe if someone else speaks, then I'll say something.
Abdul, go ahead.
It's a really good question, this question of choice. In Islamic history, at the time of the Inquisition, this idea of this question was asked: can someone hide their belief, and even outwardly do things that are contrary, like eat pork, for example, or drink alcohol, or not dress like a Muslim, but maintain their faith in their homes, and so on? And of course, we know that there was a whole nation called the Moriscos, who emerged out of post-Inquisition Spain, who lived their life as Muslims privately, and later on developed actually a very unique, Iberian, Islamic, Arabic, Spanish culture, which eventually spread to North Africa and has been preserved. And I have a very good friend, and she's just completing her PhD on this at Cambridge. So I think this question was asked, and I think dispensation was given to allow one to publicly take on a disbelief while in one's heart one maintained it. So I think the question of choice is, sometimes, does one take the dispensation to preserve life and all of that, all of what that entails for one's family and one's community, or is one's conviction so strong and so paramount that one makes the decision not to practice in private?
And I guess we could honor both positions, really.
This is a very interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, one could honor both positions, but some might even say that no, it's better to take the dispensation and live your faith privately for a time in order to ensure that there's a father in a home or a mother in a home and the communities are kept together and the faith is preserved for the next generation, and actually in a whole generations of Muslims, and I'm not sure what the story is in the Jewish tradition, but certainly in the Muslim tradition, who held on to their faith in private. So I think it's a really interesting question.
I think so too, and I love what you brought up in response. And what I want to bring out is who is setting up the situation that says, if you renounce your faith, you will die, and if you renounce your faith, you will live. If you keep your faith, you will die. So there's a hidden actor in that dilemma, the one who is threatening death to the other. And the one who's threatening death to the other is often disappears in martyr narratives. But and we get confused. We think it's God who's making that proposition to us. You know, that God who's challenging us to be willing to die for our faith. But in fact, it is persecutors, it is opposers who when Martin Luther King's life was threatened, it was the people who wanted him to stop working for racial justice in the U.S. because racial justice was going to disrupt the whole economic order. And even the military-industrial complex was threatened by the civil rights movement and racial justice. So King had opponents who said, if you don't stop doing what you're doing, you're going to die. It wasn't God who said that. And King had a choice of whether to keep going in the face of that kind of opposition, as have many who are struggling for justice. So the choice was there, but the choice was posed by the systems of evil. That systems of evil pose those kinds of choices. Even you can't openly practice your life as a Muslim without threat of, even if it's just of social censure, of being outcast, of being treated like a pariah, or not treated as a human being, or misread or not respected. Those are all threats that force people to hide. But to have to make such a choice, the forcing of that choice, is evil.
It's also true to say that in the context of you know, the Fox's Book of Martyrs type of situation, that where this was a great deal between the swing, you know, between the who was holding sway, you know, Catholicism or the Protestant kind of forces and so on. I mean, this was you know, also hugely political. It had, you know, it wasn't purely to do with faith by a long, long chalk. It was very much tied up with principalities and powers in terms of the political forces of the day and who was going to be in power and whether you were going to be in favor with whoever it was that was in power or take an opposing view or whatever. So I think things seldom come down to a simple matter of will you be true to your faith or not true to your faith. I think there are generally other issues that are kind of going on underneath of those kind of questions, really.
That individuals are forced to make.
Yeah.
I think the question is interesting because, and you highlighted beautifully, that there's these evil political, you know, unjust political contexts, power
or
politics,
social,
principalities.
Or even social, or peer pressure. Like
yeah. But for the individual, which is, I think your question, is that the man or woman placed with that choice, then it does become a personal choice of faith, doesn't it? A kind of a so while we understand the context, that question of choice is still there, the personal choice, and that what kind of spiritual transformation or adjudication does one go through in that moment of choice? And that's very powerful, actually. I think it's a lot to think about, is that what happens inside a person at that moment. So I think we can hold both those things together, yeah.
We're really just about coming to an end, really, but obviously an enormous amount of this conversation inevitably has revolved around kind of religious issues and so on, so I'm just thinking about you and I'm wondering what your reflections are.
I think if you're really interested in this issue, you need to go and look at the research. I think we've all kind of put forward our opinions and our personal takes on it, but I am a scientist, and I think there is an evidence-based approach towards looking at this, and we do have tools at our disposal to better understand this. So whilst I'm interested in the theological discussion that's gone on tonight, I think there are important psychological issues that affect modern martyrism, if that's what we call it. And I'm terribly sorry, I don't have the references here, but they are in the back of my book because I do deal with it. Because I think one of the problems I have with religion, if I may say so, is often people are always referring back to these ancient texts as if that's the only knowledge we have. And actually, there's been 2,000 years at least of studying and development of human knowledge. And in this situation, as with so many others, there are other forms of knowledge which inform our understanding of these matters. And I think the psychological research that has been done into martyrdom is fascinating. And I'm terribly sorry I haven't brought it with me, but I think we can understand, for example, what kind of person makes the choice to compromise their faith and live, and what kind of person makes the choice to hold on to their faith and die. You know, on the one hand, yes, maybe it's a question of faith, but on the other hand, it might boil down to something as mundane as personality type, you know. And we can understand these matters in these very, you know, humdrum human terms. So I don't think we always need to look to theological explanations. I think we can look to fundamentally human explanations for these behaviours.
Great, thank you. Did you want to?
I want to back up this point because you said it earlier, and I wanted to say amen to this. And there's one of the studies. I will look for the things you're referencing in your work. But one of the important studies from almost 10 years ago now is a sociologist of religion named Mark Juergensmeyer, whose book is Terror in the Mind of God. I recommend this book to you because he studied the use of religious terrorism, which includes self-sacrificing martyrs, suicide bombers, but also other forms of religiously sanctioned violence. But he interviewed and studied religious figures who use violence against themselves or others in all the traditions. He studied some Buddhists, some Jews, some Muslims, some Christians, and he makes a sociological typology of the religious framework and the psychological and political framework, so it's a social science approach to looking at religiously framed violence. And what he has to say about the common traits among the use of religiously sanctioned violence across religious traditions is really important social science research. And it also gives a lens into how religion functions to structure something you spoke about, how we make meaning. And another really significant book, I think, is Chris Hedges' book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, That Gives Life Meaning, because he argues about how dying for a cause, hardly anything that has more punch as a meaning maker than to die for a cause. And it may not, whether the cause is just, whether the cause is sensible, whether the harm that's caused is weighed, none of that outweighs how much meaning is created in military systems or war systems. And so he argues that we have to look at the meaningfulness, but he argues that this, as a structure of meaning, this may be very faulty, but it's a very appealing structure of meaning. So you spoke about that human need for meaning, and I really appreciated that.
If you look at the language politicians use around war, and when you know the Americans have thousands of dead soldiers coming home, and what they convince the parents of those dead soldiers is that they gave their lives for a greater purpose, for me, and what we're doing is a psychological contract to convince those parents that somehow the deaths of their children are justified, are meaningful, and that's in a non-religious context. We do it all the time, and I think you know, ultimately, once we have food and shelter, what we are creatures who seek meaning. And you're absolutely right. This somehow killing ourselves for a cause or dying for a cause is a shortcut to arriving at a sense of meaning. But I tell you what it is. It is just a sense of meaning.
And that meaning breaks down. And I'm involved with a project around moral injury in war, because so many soldiers come back. Soldiers are coming back in huge numbers now, some to Britain, but to the U.S. from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they are psychologically and morally in a state of complete breakdown because they went into the war believing it was meaningful, and then what they actually experienced was that it was horrendous. It destroyed their sense of selfhood. Yeah. They feel tremendous guilt for what they did. And right now in the United States, the suicide rate among returning soldiers is higher than the number of deaths that have actually happened in war. And we're studying this now. It's not the same as post-traumatic stress, PTSD, which also happens. There's a new category that Veterans Administration is using in the United States. It's called moral injury. It's the breakdown of the sense of meaning and selfhood that leads to profound despair and even to suicide. Out of that despair, it's the harm that war causes when that meaning, that illusion of meaning, which is what Augustine, source of just war theory, himself hated war. And in the City of God, he says, tear off these deceitful masks and see war clearly. For the meaninglessness and the horror of it. So this is why I am against the valorization of violence as a means of redemption.
Three real quick points. I don't disagree with Alam at all. I think there are many ways, and I said earlier, many ways to understand why people do very, very extreme things. The religious person will obviously see that human complexity as something coming from a creator who created us incredibly complex. There's four actually pieces of work, because I have some experience working in counterterrorism and sort of combating violent extremism. If you're interested, Mark Sageman, Understanding Terror Networks, Robert Pape, Dying to Win, Mark Hansen, The Economics of Suicide Bombing, I think it's called, and then Charles Kurtzman, The Missing Martyrs, all excellent pieces of research, which I think are really worth looking at, and certainly have informed my understanding of it. I do want to take issue with Alam, just for the record, on one thing, and that was his definition of Islamism, because I do believe that something like Islamism has sort of taken on the parlance of Islamism, Nazism, fascism, which frankly is silly and incorrect. There are those political movements in every religious tradition who are going to be driven by a sense of faith and a wedding of faith to politics. I think that's going to happen. It's natural. If people want to define their politics in the sense of their faith or be inspired by their faith, that I think is democratic and 100% legitimate. The fact that the Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations have now assumed power in places like Tunisia or Egypt is a sign of them engaging in a democratic process, politicizing themselves, engaging in civil society, which they have been doing. And, you know, I've had experience of those individuals. And while I don't belong to an Islamic political party, I did one time, long time ago, and I left for very strong religious reasons. I do believe there is a very legitimate discourse around politics and faith, which is happening right now in the Muslim world, which is incredibly complex and different region to region, society to society, country to country. I think there are forms of kind of Islamism, political movements which take Islam in their spiritual, that are definitely illegitimate and need to be challenged. But I think we need to be careful about our definition. And finally, if you want to think about a modern martyr, think about Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia, the young man who had his food cart, and he couldn't sell and he couldn't make money for his family, and he put himself on fire in Tunisia, and that was the spark. As many people in Libya, Syria, Egypt, the Yemen will tell you that Muhammad Bouazizi is a shaheed, is a martyr. He set himself on fire and by doing so lit the flames, which now we call the Arab Spring. There's been a lot of debate over Muhammad Bouazizi and about whether he was a martyr or not. He didn't kill anyone. He didn't injure. He just injured himself. But in making that shocking statement, opened up this door for revolution and change, which is now transforming our world. I think someone like Mohamed Bouazizi, I think his example is an interesting, that's the fault line between the personal devastation that he went through, what his family went through, what his society was going through, and yet the martyr figure that he's become in the Arab world. I think in a way, for me, that's where the fault line is, both positive, negative, confusing, and actual.
I'm sure we're very indebted to these three people for a very fascinating discussion here at the end of Greenbelt, and lots to go away and think about there. If you thought you'd come here for any kind of little light kind of entertainment, which I'm sure you didn't, that wasn't what it was about. But I think a lot to chew over, a lot to think about, a lot to disagree with, but a lot to argue about, and that's what it's, I think, what it's really all about. So let's say a big thank you to these people.